You ready?
This is the Mike Salk Show
on Seattle Sports Station.
Are you ready?
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Are you ready for a good game?
Hello and good morning, Mike Salk Show here on Seattle Sports on 710, seattlesports.com as well. Hope everybody's wide awake. Are you wide awake yet? I'm getting there. I promise to be there soon. I will, if I just sort of drift off at any point during the day and just sort of, you don't hear from me for a moment or two and you start wondering if something happened to my radio, just know I'll be potentially distracted by the PGA Championship. Started already this morning and, the super group of Tiger and Rory and Jordan tees off in 11 minutes. So, hey, you know.
But who's counting?
We all have time. Not that I know the exact time or anything like that. So, yeah. If I trail off at any moment, you'll know what's distracting me. Hopefully, everyone's feeling just a little bit better about the Mariners after yesterday. A win can certainly do that. Yesterday, it really felt like the sky was falling. A couple of losses in a row. Non-competitive offense. Nothing generated whatsoever. And then you go out, you hit a couple of home runs, and you get a really dynamic performance from Marco Gonzalez. And the next thing you know, you're like, well, you know, 500 here on the trip, and you go to Boston for four, and the Red Sox are struggling. Can you at least win two? Maybe you could sneak out a third win. All of a sudden, you'd be right back in it, and you start talking differently about the season. I think I'm willing to believe some of that stuff. I think that regardless, it doesn't make the problems go away. Right? I mean, they have issues. They don't go away just because you win a couple of games and the offense comes alive for a day. That happens. But they sure make you feel better about some of those problems, right? When you see Ty France go deep, when you see Cal Raleigh go deep, Abraham Toro hit another home run, you know, it helps. It helps kind of remind you of what this lineup can be. I will not be surprised to note that Steven Souza was not in right field yesterday. Scott's like, yeah, let's put the second baseman out there. I'm good. Think I've seen enough. How about we put Adam Frazier out there? And nothing worse than yesterday could happen, right? Like, all right, I said DFA worthy. Maybe not quite that, but certainly go sit on the bench. You're not going to be playing right field for a little while worthy. So, that's kind of the situation they're in. And the story out of yesterday kind of becomes Marco Gonzalez, who in consecutive games went out and beat two of the best pitchers, one in each league, right? Max Scherzer has been tremendous this year. Well, not just this year, tremendous for a long time. And Marco matched up with him and matched him stride for stride, I thought, in New York last week. And then yesterday, Kevin Gausman might not be the biggest name, certainly not as big as Marco is, or as Max Scherzer is, rather. But so far this year, he'd been arguably the best pitcher in the American League. I think a few other people would have a claim to that, including Logan Gilbert. But he'd be on the list of guys that like were very, very way too early contenders for a Cy Young Award. And Marco was just flat out better than him, right? He walked in a one run, and other than that, he was nearly perfect last night, moving the ball around, keeping hitters off balance. And yet, all anybody wants to do, even when Marco pitches well, is say what he's not, rather than what he is. Scott Servais for sure.
Yeah, well, Marco's not sexy. You know, he doesn't throw 95.
Can we tell
On baseball, everything today's about velocity, you know, and everybody gets excited when Mooney's out there throwing 99 and Logan, you know, almost hits 100 last night. You know, there's a lot of different ways to get people out, and Marco takes pride in what he does. When he steps on the mound, he feels like he can throw 100. But he locates, he changes speeds, and he wins. You know, there's a lot to be said for that.
Well, not anymore. You're not allowed. Wins don't matter in the Major League Baseball anymore.
He feels like he could throw 100.
Well, he kind of does. I mean, Marco, is there anybody who kind of internalizes even small slights more than Marco? Like, I'm pretty sure Scott said that just to get under Marco's skin to make him pitch better. If I were managing Marco Gonzalez, I think that's what I would do. He seems to really kind of thrive off of the perceived slights and anything, right? He kind of works himself into a lather out there on the mound. I think bulldog is probably the best word to describe him, and not just because he went to Gonzaga, but because that's sort of what he pitches like. He's stubborn. He's determined. He is crafty and smart in the way he goes about his business out there. He definitely hears everything that everyone says, including what his manager said yesterday.
I mean, I guess you said it. I'm not sexy, but I'm still here.
The hair is, you know.
But I'm still here, and I'm still getting dudes out. So I don't know what to tell you. If you don't think I can pitch this level, then I love it because I'm gonna keep proving you wrong. I've done it my entire career.
I love that, man.
That's fantastic.
It's so good. It is such a. I mean, there's a straw man there. Nobody said he can't pitch at this level, right? Who believes that Marco Gonzalez isn't a major leaguer? Well, that would be ridiculous.
Do you think he means at the level he has, like, going toe-to-toe with some of the best the last couple of starts?
I don't know.
He might not mean big league level.
I don't know. I hope so. Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm mishearing it. Quite frankly, I hope he means big league level, and he's just out here, like, essentially internalizing everything anyone says about him and turning it into his opportunity to there you go shirt, to just have that extra edge that he needs. And when you don't throw 95 to 99 in today's modern game, maybe you do need a little. I can't concentrate with right side Fred on. I'm sorry. It's hard enough while I'm trying to concentrate while the PGA Championship is on, but now you're going to throw right side Fred at me? That's just that might be a bridge too far for him.
I will say he's updated. If you didn't see it, his Twitter bio is now very boring and not sexy.
And very boring and not sexy.
No sex.
Poor guy. His own organization. So both his catcher and his manager yesterday referred to him as not sexy. Now, I don't know if that was just Divish sort of trying to plant a seed and being a little bit of an instigator. But both his manager and his catcher were like, yeah, not sexy.
Well, and Marco could have easily been like, you know what else isn't sexy? Your 100
you.
Batting average.
Oh, I was going to say either of you.
Yeah.
I mean, Cal Raleigh's a lot of things, right? I mean, so is Scott. I don't know whether sexy is the word people would use. I mean, certainly when your nickname is the Big Dumper, there's the opportunity yeah. to be sexy in your own way. But
kind of precludes you from being.
Hey, I'm sure there's a group of people for everything, but yeah, no, I you got to give Marco a lot of credit, right? Not just for his last couple of games, but for everything he's done. He does not throw 95 to 100, but I don't know that I would refer to Marco as not having good stuff. I would say he's got very good stuff, right? He's got that cutter. He's got the changeup. He's got 2, 3, 4 different pitches he can use to keep people off balance, and I think the Mariners have done, a good job since he came over from St. Louis in helping him develop and choose which pitches he wants to use. It seems to be the more I kind of watch guys go from place to place, the more I'm realizing how important pitch selection is in terms of strategy, not just tactics, right? So tactics would be which pitch you call in a certain situation, but strategy would be your overall, like, sort of which pitches you're focusing on and how you want to use them together to try to get guys out. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
So in the Paul Sewald's probably an even clearer example, and not just because the Mets wanted him to be a sidearmer and all that. I mean, obviously that's sort of going above and beyond. But when the Mariners decided that strategically the best plan for Paul Sewald was high fastballs and then sliders to his glove side, right? And when that change took place, that became a strategy. And now it's up to him and the catcher to determine the tactics in each game of when you call each pitch. And then it's up to him to try to, you know, to execute on those pitches and throw them exactly where he wants to throw them. But with Marco, my understanding is they did make some changes to the strategy when he came over. And it's led to him really becoming, if not one of the best pitchers in baseball, certainly somebody that you trust every 5 days when he's out there on the mound. Will he have the occasional blow up? Yes. Is he an ace? No, probably not. And maybe you got to add that to the number of things that he's not. He's boring. He's not exciting. He's not sexy. He's very boring. And he's probably not an ace of a really, really good baseball team, but he's absolutely a top three pitcher. He's absolutely somebody that you count on over the course of a season who makes your playoff roster and starts a playoff game for you when you eventually get there. And if he needs to internalize something that somebody says about him every day in order to get there, good for him. He's just one of many who have done that over the years, and I love it, right? It's Lawyer Malloy. It's Rodney Harrison.
How do you not love it?
Right? It's Richard Sherman. It's who's talking about you, right? Like, no one's talking about you, Richard Sherman, but you've made it up in your head, and you've allowed that to become a rallying cry for you. And if Marco's the same way, I love it. I support it 100%. All right. Next Friday, the 27th, How about 90s night at T-Mobile Park? Mariners neon pink hats for the first 10,000 fans as they take on the Astros. 6:40 first pitch. You put on that neon hat, and you can definitely play. There you go. Play me a little bit more Right Said Fred. They would definitely. There it is. They fit together. I'd look good in a neon pink hat. I wear a lot of neon pink, as you can imagine.
We can save you one.
Thank you. Appreciate that. All right, an epic start to a heated rivalry. That and everything else you need to know next. Mike Salk Show here on Seattle Sports Station, 710, salesports.com. And I'm too sexy
for your party. Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Mike Salk.
Here's what you need to know. Up first.
Mariners keep getting themselves in situations that feel must-win despite the early date here on the calendar. Much like the rubber match in New York, found a way to make it happen yesterday, this time salvaging a game in Toronto. Marco Gonzalez, excellent, throwing six innings of one-run ball. They needed it, but we all know it wouldn't have been enough, not the way the bats have been going recently. Thankfully, Ty France providing a little bit of thunder.
Ty France, first pitch, swung on, drive deep to left center field. That thing got carry. It is gone. A two-run rocket by Ty France, and the Mariners have a 4-1 lead. Jumped on the first pitch, a high fastball. Got it into the front row, left center field.
Yeah, it was good to see. He was kind of limping around, said afterwards that it's a hip flexor issue, but says he'll be okay. It's just a hip flexor. No big deal. Home runs for Cal Raleigh and Abraham Toro as well last night. Mariners win it. 5-1, maybe even more impressive against Kevin Gausman, too. He's been one of the best in baseball so far this year. So, yes, in the last week, the Mariners beat Max Scherzer and Kevin Gausman, but lost to Yusei Kikuchi and a struggling Barrios. Go figure. That's kind of how this team has been. Worth noting, Steven Souza not back in right field the day after his rough start. Todd Frazier played right while Toro was at second. And now they'll head off to Boston for four. Red Sox limp in. They're just 15-22 on the season, not playing very good baseball. George Kirby and Rich Hill get it started this afternoon. And, yes, everyone has noted what an odd combination those two make. Kirby young, Hill old. Kirby throws about as hard as anybody in the league. Rich Hill exactly the opposite. But the Wiley veterans found a lot of ways to get people out, so got to take that seriously today. Back to 500, of course, now on the road trip. Kind of the magic number you want to see them reach before they come back home. Just survive May. Don't just get so far out in May and so far behind that June, July, August, and September are not really relevant. If you can survive May and stay close to 500, yeah, we could still have some fun this summer.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
Well, it sounds like some changes coming to the Pac-12, the league deciding that teams with the two top winning percentages will face each other in the championship games, scrapping the old formula where division winners battle. Here's the quote from Pac-12 Commissioner George Klivikoff. He said, "Our goal is to place our two best teams in our Pac-12 football championship game, which we believe will provide our conference with the best opportunity to optimize college football playoff invitations and ultimately win national championships." Well, yeah, all right. I'm not sure how much this is going to help the conference in general, but it should improve USC's chances of making the playoffs because their extra win will be against a slightly better team, hopefully for them, against Oregon. I guess I'm just pretty convinced that USC and Oregon are going to dominate this conference now for a long, long time based on their willingness to spend money, the money that they have to spend, and just the increased importance of that in this new NIL system. And everything you hear about what's going on locally at Washington and even at Wazoo is that they just don't have either the money nor the willingness to spend what those others are in these NIL deals. So until something changes in college football, we are going to see a bit of a reshuffling of the deck, and teams not just necessarily with the most history, but with the boosters and others that are willing to spend in order to make them great are going to have a huge, huge leg up on everybody else.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
All right, the blowouts continue in the NBA. First, it was Miami in the East. Last night, it was Golden State in the West, just taking it to Dallas in Game 1. A 25-point victory, never really in doubt, so they lead 1-0. Pretty great start, though, to both series in the NHL. First, it was Ian Cole putting in the game winner in overtime for Carolina. And then a crazy offensive explosion in a heated rivalry, the Battle of Alberta. Flames lead, led 3-0, and then 6-2. Oilers come all the way back, tie it at 6. Then the Flames scored three more. 9-6, your final. Two each for Hyman and Coleman, and then Matthew Tkachuk topped both of them.
To the Oiler bench, so the extra attacker back on. The net is empty, and it's empty for Tkachuk.
Yeah, that was his third of the game. Have you seen the video of his dad refusing to throw in his hat?
Yeah.
Pretty great. Keith Tkachuk's like, yeah, I'm not throwing my hat. Dude, your son just scored a hat trick in a playoff game against their rival. Yeah, I don't care. I'm not throwing my hat.
That's a guy who likes memorabilia.
Darn right. PGA Championship is underway very, very early, but Robert McIntyre does lead by a stroke over a whole bunch of people. He is 2 under. And yes, Tiger and Rory and Jordan all just teed off a couple of minutes ago. All right. That is everything you need to know. And do that quarter past every hour all throughout the morning. In fact, all three are have hit their green in regulation just to start off this morning. Does anybody care about this as much as me? Am I just giving you updates on something you don't care about at all? Probably, huh? I guess that's kind of how this is going.
I like watching the condensed highlights after the fact. I love watching on a weekend. Especially if it's bad weather and I got nothing. We're watching golf for 4 hours.
Well, it's actually supposed to be nice weather this weekend, which I don't believe, looking outside here over the last couple of weeks or looking just at the long-term forecast. This has been the worst spring in the history of Seattle. It has to be. I mean, maybe there have been worse, but it's hard for me to fathom.
According to actual rain levels, the only one that was worse is 2011.
Okay, so yeah, there you go. The second worst spring in history so far. I mean, you know, can we get a couple of days of sun?
Yesterday and last night wasn't bad. I went and watched the Mariners game at Buckley. Took our motorcycle ride up to Backfire. It was pretty good, but chilly.
Right, and it was windy. It was like a freaking hurricane out there yesterday.
Yep,
it was the temperature might have been warm, but it was like October.
Oh no, it was 51 when I got to.
Okay, so yeah, I don't want to hear it, man. Could we get sun and warmth together for a day or two? Would that kill anybody?
I would
hope not.
Best I can do is 51 degrees and partially sunny, 40 mile an hour winds.
That would be great. Thanks. Thanks, Justin. I'd like to change my order, if you don't mind. I'd like to send that one back and do something else.
So. Also, Brash yesterday. 2 innings pitched, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts.
Only 1 walk? That's good to see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty important.
What wasn't great was Kyle Lewis, Kelnick, and White all went 0-for with 4 strikeouts. But
that's all right. I mean, again, you know, those guys are going to have to kind of work through it, especially in Evan White's case. Just good to see him back out there. In the case of Kyle Lewis, again, that's good news that he was able to go back-to-back days. So while maybe they didn't have a hit, you know, good to see. And we'll be watching. Huh?
He got walked at least, so.
And we'll be watching Jared Kelnick kind of see where that goes here over the next couple of weeks. And it may take him some time to kind of resettle himself and kind of, you know, get himself into the right mind space to kind of go out there and dominate AAA pitching, which I feel very confident he will do. And then kind of, you know, he's going to need some work with, I would think, some hitting coaches, et cetera. Maybe he's got to go back and talk to Mark McGwire again. I don't know. Whatever it is, he's got to go do it to kind of put himself in the right position now, in the right headspace to eventually kind of turn this thing around. So looking forward to that. And yeah, that's good. Please keep me updated. I'm going to try to get down there actually next week and see if I can watch a Rainiers game. So that's my plan. They're out of town this week, but my plan anyway is to try to get down there next week.
I love going to games at that field.
It really is fun. It's a beautiful place and great to be down there. If I could find a way to play Chambers, be done, and then go right over to the ballpark, that would be perfect. So let me see if I can work that out. All right. Coming up next, he's one of my favorite interviews we've done in a while. I really enjoyed talking to Clint Hurt yesterday. And after listening to him, I don't know how any Seahawks fan can't believe that the defense is going to be better than it's been. It's next. Mike Salk Show here on Seattle Sports on 710 and the Seattle Sports app.
You're listening to the Mike Salk Show.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
On Seattle Sports Station.
Good morning, Clint. Thanks for doing this. And I'll kind of jump right into it. Now, you've had this job now for a few months. What's it been like?
You know what? It's been a lot of fun, you know, putting this whole thing together. But obviously, time-consuming as well. But in a good way. You know, obviously, like I said, we've got some changes going on. But with the staff, you know, coming together with Sean and Carl and obviously the guys that have been here with JG, Coach Curry and Coach Lewis, just putting this whole thing together has been a lot of fun. And now finally having our players being in the building now for the last 5 weeks we're in now, it's been really, really good to see. And the guys are really taking to the new changes we've had going in. So the energy and the commitment to it from the players and the coaches has been really good.
Do you have a family?
Yes, I do.
Do you see them ever? Have you seen them for the last few months? Do they still know you?
They still know me. My wife is definitely trying to make the adjustment now. We've been in this for a long time, so she gets it, but this has definitely been different because usually in the off season, I'm helping to pick kids up from school or I'm cooking more meals and things like that, but it definitely has not been that this spring.
Well, I'm sure, and I'm sure even in the moments where you are helping, it's got to be hard to get ideas out of your head, right? You got to be almost constantly formulating some of the thoughts and where you want to go this year.
That part is definitely different. It's just always, schematically, where we want to go, what's needed, how things are being coached, how we want to handle the install for the players, what's too much, things of that nature, what calls do I have to get in certain situations to make sure the players are seeing what they need to get them prepared and ready to go. So it's definitely it's 24/7 in a different aspect. So that part's been really cool.
No, it's awesome. So tell me a little bit about the 3-4, because we've heard from Pete over the years, right? It's a 4-3 with some 3-4 principles or 3-4 personnel at times. And yet it seems like maybe you did make some changes to the style of personnel you went after this offseason. Can you tell me a little bit about the 3-4, why it's your favorite, why you came to it, and what it'll look like for us fans?
I was raised and grew in a 4-3 system in my time, even through high school, but even at the University of Miami. But then obviously when I got into the whole coaching world, what I started to realize in the transition of how football is changing, with all the spread offenses and the zone read and RPO concepts and things of that nature, you want to have the ability to be balanced, and what happens is formationally, a lot of times offenses can put you in certain formations and sets to make you uncover so you can see coverage. They can see coverage-wise what you're doing. And obviously in today's game, everything is all about how you affect the quarterback, not only by pressuring and hitting and sacking him, but also, screwing with his reads, pre-snap and post-snap, and the things you can do with that. And what 3-4 allows you to do is you can be balanced and be able to play out of a too high shell and be able to cover down with your edge guys and whatnot when necessary. So anything that you can do to make the quarterback have to work, and I believe it's more than half the teams in the NFL right now are playing 3-4 defenses. So that's where the league is trending, and it's not a surprise. You look at all the quarterbacks that's coming in the league right now and all the RPO stuff that's across the league, it's something that you got to have. And here's the thing. It's not that if you go 3-4 that you just don't have any 4-3 elements to your defense. That's not true. A lot of the fronts and things like that, the multiplicity that you can give, you can still play over and under structures that you usually have in 4-3 defenses, but you can also play balanced and play as a 0 and 2-4 techniques and have overhangs and things of that nature. So the multiplicity of 3-4 defense is why I've become a big fan of it, because I can get to whatever I need to with that structure and principle and the principles with it coverage-wise as well.
What's an overhang?
Overhang, like outside linebacker is what an overhang would be. So a guy, whether if you have a 2-detached or a spread formation, I can walk a guy out, and that's a big guy on a slide. That doesn't mean he's playing man-to-man, so nobody needs to sweat bullets about that. But I can get reroutes and beat that guy up. He can still be blitzing and coming off the edge and things of that nature. But it's problematic when you got a big guy, but obviously somebody has some athleticism, guys like Daryl Taylor and Chenna. And Boye Mafe that we obviously just got in the fold.
Yeah.
It's a different deal when you got guys like that out in space, out on the edges.
Well, when I think of the 3-4, I grew up in New England, but I was Lawrence Taylor's my favorite player of all time. And when I think of the 3-4.
We get along real good.
Well, good.
Yep.
He's the best I've ever seen do anything, maybe in any sport. And when I think of the 3-4, I think of him as an outside linebacker. I mean, will this look similar to what those Giants teams used to do? Brock was telling me earlier that the 3-4 of today doesn't have, the gigantic nose tackle eating up space and huge, middle linebackers plugging holes. How has that adapted and evolved over the years?
I think a lot of it is adapted by the style of, the style of player that you have do it. I would still say that guys like Al Woods and Brian Monet are pretty massive themselves. So that still fits because that guy's responsibility is to keep the backers clean and still be a factor himself. If they single block him, that guy's got to be able to get off of blocks and make tackles. But I would say that because of today's game and it being more of a space game, you really don't find the 260-pound linebackers like you saw back then with Pepper Johnson and Harry Carson and those guys. That you're gonna be, you have to be able to play in space. And those guys were great players in their own right. But today, generally, your normal linebackers are in that 6'1", 235 to 245 range because the speed and short area quickness, like I said, because of it being more so a space game in today's football, The ability to run and hit is accentuated even more, is what I would say. But in terms of structurally and the same format of that, and big guys being able to two-gap and in some situations play a one-gap scheme, all those things still have big-time carryover. And, hell, if we can continue to develop Daryl Taylor, one of these guys, to get into that echelon of some of those old-time greats, we'll be really happy around here in Seattle.
I'll tell you what, if this is the modern Lawrence Taylor, Carl Banks situation, I'll be very happy watching, that's for sure. We're talking to Clint Hurt here on Seattle Sports on 710, Seahawks defensive coordinator. How does that affect the secondary? I mean, this is obviously what the front seven does. Will it change the way the secondary functions for the Seahawks?
Yes. I mean, some of the principles are different. You know, here we've always been a big vision. Our cover three stuff has been a lot of vision and break, spot drop.
What does that mean? You know, what does that mean?
Vision and break, really what that means is you have two different principles when you play zone coverage in this league. Some teams are spot drops where you're really focused on hitting landmarks. And, you know, and you, once you get to your depth, you get your vision on the quarterback and you're melting and moving off the eyes of the quarterback and reading his shoulders and whatnot, where he's going with the football. And then you got to break and react on the ball. You know, and the other side you can play is more of a zone matchup principle where you're really playing bodies and pattern matching more so than playing in an area. So are you playing a man or are you playing an area? Mm. There's a difference. So you have either zone match or you have spot drop vision and break is okay. Really how I look at it. And we've been a vision and break defense here for a really long time. And we'll have some of those principles in certain calls that'll stay alive. But the big thing right now is obviously the ability to pattern match, and you got to be able to react to the stems of receivers and whatnot and match up with people. So that's where things, it's going to help out. Well, number one, it helps the guys on the back end where you can play stickier and challenge routes more and be in position to get your hands on the football a lot more. Two, it also helps affect the pass rush, you know, because now if we can make that quarterback choke and kind of hold on to the other split second, that's usually what you need for the rush in order to be able to get home. So that's the big part right now that our guys are going through and learning and doing really well with that right now.
That's got to be an interesting conversation with Pete, and I know I've heard you talk about how he's been a resource and you have his full confidence and the full autonomy to do what you want to do. When I think of Pete, I think of his almost number one defensive principle of being don't get beat deep. And this sounds like, while it's more aggressive, that's got to be a little bit riskier, no?
No, I wouldn't agree with that.
Okay, good.
Well, yeah, what I would say is just everything is all about how you teach it.
Okay.
And making sure you're playing sound football and not putting players in compromised positions. That's obviously my job, and we're not going to do that. We're going to be – you can still be aggressive. And aggressive does not always mean that you're blitzing all the time either. You know, there's a way how you coach things, the mentality that you want to give your players to have confidence in what they're doing is the aggressive mentality we're talking about. And when we have pressures, absolutely. But we can rush four and drop seven and still have an aggressive mindset, a physical mindset. Collectively as a whole is what I'm referring to. But what the thing is, obviously, in any defensive scheme, you don't want to give up explosives and not getting beat deep because obviously explosives, they lead to points. And if teams are scoring points, you're not going to win a whole lot of football games. So you got to be great on that aspect of it. So we're still going to be preaching being aggressive around here. That part is not going to change, but I don't want people thinking that means it's going to be Blitz City either.
Good. Cool. Tell me about Jamal Adams. What's next for him?
Right now, the most important thing is, one, him continuing to get healthy like he's been doing. And then, obviously, there's the carryover in the scheme. There is some carryover for certain things in it, but there's a lot of new learning as well. And he's been I've been speaking with him. He's been speaking with Coach Desai and Coach Scott as well, continuing to learn his stuff and get him up to speed. And also, and putting him in positions to be successful, to be at the best version of himself. He got a lot better, you know, and a lot, we hear all the little talk and stuff like that about, you know, these things he has to get better at. Jamal is a guy that's a workaholic. He pays attention to the details. He got a lot better playing, you know, quarter coverage safety last year with those things. And now it's continuing to accentuate what he does great. Well, what is that? He's great as an underneath defender. He's an outstanding run fit defender and tackler and aggressor. Obviously, we already know what he is as a blitzer. All right, that comes very natural to him. But it's just continuing to detail out his coverage responsibilities and whatnot. And he's putting all his work in on that right now, along with getting healthy.
You know, one of the other things you do this year that I'm sure is new and different is actually calling defensive plays. And I had never really thought much of that. We hear so much more about offensive play callers. And then in talking about Hasselbeck this year, he was making an argument that maybe even it's more important in terms of defensive play callers than offense. And I'd never really heard anybody say that before. What is your plan to really call defensive plays for the first time?
Right now, everything is I'm doing is preparing myself for it. You know, I go in my office, I'll go through, watch game tapes, and I already have the personnels and the down and distances in, and I'll just call games as I'm watching them with as things go on and scenarios and whatnot. So those are things that you do to prepare yourself. Obviously, in practice, we'll have call-it periods where I'll get plenty of time at that. But my thought process is I already have a – I can't say this because I don't want anybody being able to pull this up and listen to it and say, okay, this is how this guy's thinking. But – you have a mentality as a play caller and what you believe in. And then obviously it's something when it's new to you, you got to work through. The benefit that I have is, you know, some of the ideas and thoughts of what I'm doing now to prepare myself, I'm taking from Sean because this is what Sean did to prepare himself. It's just been a great resource for me because obviously last season in Chicago was his first time being a play caller. And I can bounce thoughts and ideas off of him. And he can talk to me obviously about what his experience was and maybe things that he wanted to do differently or things that he really helped, he felt benefited him in going into this. So he's been a great resource for me in that aspect. But a lot of it now is just watching film after film after film. We have a majority of our stuff is installed right now in terms of our first, second down, third down calls and 2-minute calls right now. So I have the ability to go through our stuff and make calls as I see it on the tape, you know, and kind of start to get myself prepared for it. And we start OTAs next week versus the offense. So, again, those will be play calling situations for me. So it's something I'm not – I'll be over-prepared going into the season. I'm going to make sure cool. I'm ready for that. That's my responsibility.
It strikes me that one of the most important and challenging things that any coordinator has to do in the NFL is keep things simple enough for his team to be able to get it. We talked to Shane Waldron last week. He talked about the illusion of complexity, keeping things simple for his offense while making it hard on the defense. I had the, whether you call it the privilege or the curse, of interviewing Bill Belichick every week after a game for a year. And as you can imagine, he didn't give me a tremendous amount. But when we would talk to him about things other than the Patriots, he was great. And I used to just ask him about the old Giants teams. And he started talking to me about how the Cowboys under Tom Landry had this crazy complex defense because every year the same guys were there. And they played there for a decade plus, and they could just add and add and add to it. And how that's changed now, right, with free agency and everybody coming and going. You really got to find ways to simplify it. How much time do you spend on that challenge of trying to make it complex yet simple to understand?
That, to me, that's what it's all about. Because once you get in your principles and your techniques within the system, you teach those techniques to all your players so they know, you know, how a guy plays quarter flat or multiple coverage techniques that you have within the system, then what you're able to do is like, and not have a lot. You know, if you have four different responsibilities, five different responsibilities a guy can have, but all the players learn it, then what you have the ability to do is you can move your chess pieces around. Mm. You can move Jamal Adams. You can move Jordan Brooks. You can move Quandre Diggs, who are, you know, your guys that where you want to put your guy, your top guys in positions to be super successful. Darrell Taylor, same way. And now they can play in multiple spots. And what happens is that screws with the offense because when the structure changes, then their blocking schemes, pass protections have to change. Who they account for in the running game has to change. So the complexity to the offense is difficult because they have a lot of different things they have to prepare for blocking scheme-wise. But for the defense, for us, it's not hard because the techniques stay the same. We're just changing alignments and things of that nature as well.
Yeah.
For us, that's how we create the complexity for the offense.
At your core, would you say that you are someone who wants the offense to have to react to your defense, or do you build a defense that has to match up and react to what the offense is doing?
I want the defense to have to react to us, but I will always say defense is a reactionary game. You have to react to what you're getting, you know, this, no matter what, whether you're adjusting to a formation, a motion, things of that nature. But with our calls and our aggressiveness, we have to make the offense have to play on their heels to us, too, in terms of what we're giving them. But I would say just as a defensive player, you react to everything that you get. But we got to make sure we have enough complexity that we cannot let them be overly confident and feel like they can just roll off the ball because we're so simple with our structure and the things that we're doing that we're not challenging them mentally and physically.
How many times did you watch those LT highlights as a kid?
I grew up watching them all the time. You know, I'm a New Yorker.
Oh, really?
My dad would have kicked me out of the house if I wasn't a Giants fan.
I grew up with that VHS I had of LT. It was like the NFL Crunch Course. And just him yelling at everybody, talking trash, and blowing up every quarterback, every running back. What an absolute freak he was.
Hey, listen, that's my guy. My favorite player of all time was Lawrence Taylor. It's all not right. Even remotely close.
All right, sometime you and I are just going to get together and do a whole interview just on LT. But I appreciate this, man. This is great. I'm sure you got more film to go study and stuff to go work on, so we'll let you go. But really appreciate it, and good luck this year. We're looking forward to watching it.
Thank you so much for having me. You take care.
Love Clint Hurt now after listening to that. Mike Salk Show here on Seattle Sports on 710. Not just the LT thing, obviously that really appealed to me. But tell me you don't love the guy and feel just a little bit better about the direction that their defense is going. And I admit that, like a lot of people, I think when they were deciding on who they wanted to hire, I was a little biased against Clint Hurt because he'd been in the organization for the last few years, right? Like, hey, if he's been here, how come he hasn't fixed this thing? And so I probably was a little unfairly biased against him for that reason. But A, listening to him, you can't help but be impressed. And B, it sure sounds like he's not necessarily, you know, running, that he hadn't been doing his real passion, right? Or the way he truly would run a defense. He's a 3-4 guy, not a 4-3 guy. He wants to change the entire style of way their secondary is functioning. And when you hear those things, like, okay, good, right?
Well, and he clearly was not a fan of dropping, you know, Puna Ford or
clearly
guys
not
like
that
back into coverage either.
Right? Like, I love that cut from his press conference where he said all the guys were calling him or texting him and being like, hey, we're not dropping back into coverage anymore, are we? And he's like, no, we're going to have you guys moving forward towards the quarterback. But he clearly didn't like the way the secondary was playing with their spot drop and all of that. And again, I feel sort of ridiculous using some of these phrases, but I thought he did a pretty good job of explaining it. And we'll have Brock do a little bit more of that in an hour and really kind of explain what he means in some of those differences between his 3-4 and the 4-3 that they've been running. But, you know, for everyone, Maura, I know you're on this list. Brock is certainly on this list, and there's a lot of others as well, saying, I don't understand how for the last few years, a team that says it's all about the ball plays a coverage style that doesn't seem at all conducive to taking the ball away. If you're all about the ball, why are you sitting back so far in coverage and not more aggressive, right?
That was my favorite thing that he said, was that they're going to have a stickier, more aggressive zone match, because it just felt like they were waiting 15 yards downfield for the guy to catch it and then tackling him.
And that's
fine.
And
you were saying that maybe they played a little more like that with the LOB, but they had the personnel to do it. It's like, well, yeah, because then the guy wouldn't complete the catch at that point.
Right.
But few years, they've been just waiting for them to catch it.
I had been talking to Brock about that yesterday on the podcast, on the Brock and Salk podcast, which you can get at brockandsalkpodcast.com. And he was kind of making some of that point. Well, I was asking about it, and he was saying that essentially, there's value to the system the Seahawks were running, right? It wouldn't be a system if it wasn't like they. It wouldn't be a system if it didn't have value. And it sounds like when you have great players playing it, it can be really effective. But maybe this system is a little bit more universal and can get the most out of non-Hall of Famers, which the Seahawks may have a few more of at this point. So. I thought that was exciting. And then just listening to him talk and the rest of it, like he's got a presence about him, I think, when he walks into a room that has me excited. I don't know if that means the Seahawks are going to all of a sudden win 10, 11 games this year, but hopefully there's a long-term prognosis of this defense with him and Sean Desai and Carl Scott and some of the young players that they've drafted here over the last couple of years and some of the emphasis on it, where instead of it being an embarrassment, instead of it being something where, you know, Pete can't even look at it and can't call the game the way he wants to call it because his defense can't be trusted, you know, hopefully this changes that by quite a bit. So
there's a certain level of like accountability in the way that what he's saying too that strikes me. That stands out. It feels like he either isn't going to do the full on talking point coach speak to explain around issues when he maybe will just say what you need to hear and like, yeah, answer your question.
Straight talk kind of guy, right? Absolutely a straight talk kind of guy. So, yeah, that was really fun. I don't know. I like the text here. It says, Justin and Maura take notes. That's how you do an interview.
Of course you like
Great job, Michael. Great questions, bro. Starting to like Clint, was worried when he was hired, but liking what I'm hearing. How about that? Are you guys taking notes? Interview notes?
That's all I did.
Okay. That's good to hear. That's important.
Justin and I sometimes help talk prep.
What? That can't possibly be true.
I mean, let's,
I do
let's
everything
be
good on this show by myself, and it's only, no, so, you guys couldn't do more.
Another text here reminded me of Warren Sapp.
Interesting.
His voice is not that far off.
I'd have to hear it in order to put that one together. I don't know that I would have necessarily come up with that, but yeah, it's pretty cool for a Northeastern guy, a guy from the Northeast. We'll excuse him being a New Yorker because he loves LT so much. And so, yeah, I could literally sit around talking about LT forever. All right, good stuff there from Clint Hurt. You know, one thing I found myself thinking about, and I'll kind of get a little deeper into this here in a couple minutes, is and I was thinking about it watching the hockey last night and then thinking about the Seahawks and watching the Mariners. You know what the Seahawks have that the Mariners and Kraken don't?
What?
Stars.
Oh, okay.
They don't have as many as they once did. But when you see DK Metcalf out there and the world instantly recognizes him and you know that in a big spot he can make a game-changing play, he's a star, right? They may not have as many as they once did, and with, you know, no Bobby and Russ gone and, you know, some of the LOB stuff, like over the last 5 or 6 years, some of the stars have walked out of here, but there's still some stars. Jamal Adams is still a star in his own way, and I think that, excuse me, Quandre Diggs is sort of turning into one at times. So
Tyler Lockett's been one.
Tyler Lockett has been a, like, you've got guys who can make game-changing plays. And as you watch the Mariners, it's just like, man, they're good. They don't really have stars yet. And maybe Logan Gilbert is turning into one, and eventually we think Julio will be one, etc. But I think that's sort of the Marco Gonzalez thing yesterday, right? Like, oh, I'm not sexy, very boring, all of that. I guess I mean more in their lineup, where, you know, you don't have that one guy where you're sitting around waiting for it to come back around to him. And then, you know, watching the hockey last night, and you're going, jeez, you know, Connor McDavid, and I know they didn't win the game last night, but watching him and his just single-handed effort to put his team on his back and score 6 goals the way they did last night was tremendous, right? Watching Draisaitl, watching Tkachuk, watching Johnny Gaudreau. Like, you've got to have stars in the modern version of sports.
Oh, Vlad coming to the plate, like, right? That feeling.
Yeah, you're sitting there waiting, like, checking the lineup, like, man, how far away are they from Vlad? Can you put a runner on base, or is Vlad about to be up? So, I want to dig a little deeper into that as we kind of figure out where the Mariners are, because as I watch these 2022 Mariners, I think they're a bizarro team, and I'll explain what I mean next. Mike Salk Show here on Seattle Sports on 710 and seattlesports.com.